this time on your weekly Constitutional. Can the government take your property and give it to somebody else?
It wasn't only some judges or legal scholars who were critical of QO. The decision met with an enormous public backlash, even with ordinary people.
Professor Ilya Soman of George Mason University gives us an update since the infamous Kelo decision of 2005. We'll also hear from Professor Pat Baker of the University of Tennessee at Martin, who'll tell us about a specific issue dealing with mines.
This taking argument is a very tangible, real argument, I think, that can be made, because essentially what the state is doing is an end run around the Fifth Amendment.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week it's all about property rights, the Kelo decision, and mines.
It's time for your Weekly Constitutional, a weekly discussion of interesting constitutional issues from gay rights to gun rights. YWC is produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier, and is hosted by Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law in Knoxville, Tennessee.
The Kelo decision of 2005 is one of the most notorious Supreme Court decisions in recent history. Why? Because the court essentially ruled that the Constitution of the United States does not prohibit a government from taking your property and then turning right around and giving it to a private developer who makes whatever promises he's going to make about all the great things he's going to do for your city or town. Kelo has inspired an enormous backlash. It's inspired all sorts of constitutional amendments at the state level, state statutes, court decisions, and of course, a big public outcry that you may remember. I was reminded of this and started thinking that maybe it was time to do an update on Kelo when a friend of mine, his name is Pat Baker, and he teaches at the University of Tennessee at Martin, when he wrote a very interesting paper that was at least initially titled, Who Owns Nothing? The nothing in question is the space that's left over underground after you take the coal out of a mountainside. Who owns that? Actually, it's in dispute, and that dispute is coming to a head as people figure out valuable uses for those so-called mine voids. But before we get to mineral rights, let's start with a general overview of Kelo and its aftermath.
My name is Ilya Soman. I'm a law professor at George Mason University, where I teach constitutional law and property, among other subjects. I also blog regularly for the Volokh Conspiracy blog, V-O-L-O-K-H. In recent years, I've been the author of several books, including Democracy and Political Ignorance, and probably the one that we'll talk about most today, The Grasping Hand, Kelo versus City of New London, and The Limits of Eminent Domain.
The Grasping Hand, that's an inspired title.
Thank you.
And the Volokh Conspiracy is a group that we're very familiar with here. In fact, I just got off the phone a week or two ago with Eugene. So it's nice to have another conspirator on the line.
Thank you very much for having me.
Okay, let's talk about Kelo. In fact, let's go back to the beginning. Let's talk about what this thing called eminent domain is and the condemnation process. Let's go back and from the very beginning.
Eminent domain is a process that the government uses to take private property when they need it for some sort of project or think they need it, but the owner isn't willing to sell voluntarily. So instead, the government says, we're going to condemn your property, and the price we're going to pay you is one set by a court rather than one that you might be willing to accept voluntarily. So the standard that the Supreme Court has set up for that is that it has to be fair market value, the price that the land would get if you sold it on the open market. The Constitution and also many states.
Let me interrupt you there. Before we get to the Constitution, this is an ancient doctrine, isn't it? I mean, doesn't this go all the way back to the King of England and the idea that he owned everything and that he could take it back whenever he wanted to?
It's not so much that he owned everything as that, in, at least supposedly, a government is supposed to have this residual power to take property for public projects, mm-hmm. which is not the same thing as the government just owning everything. But it is indeed an ancient tradition, actually goes back even before the kings of England, but all the way back to the ancient world.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. So governments have always felt a need occasionally simply to take private property, which is understandable when you think about public works like roads or aqueducts, if you want to go back to ancient Rome. But it's always, I imagine, controversial with regard to the property owners themselves. I mean, we like to think that we own our properties completely and that we're the king of our little castle. But I guess that's never really been the case then, has it?
Probably not, though. Just because governments have always claimed this power doesn't necessarily mean that it's a good idea or that it's just. Kings, emperors, and other kinds of government often claim various powers that it's very questionable whether they should actually have them.
Yeah, I guess so. Well, okay, so it's an ancient doctrine. It comes down to us through our own constitutional heritage. And as you've said, it still exists. And you were just about to tell me what the Constitution has to say about it.
Sure. The Fifth Amendment to the Constitution, and also provisions in virtually every state constitution, because every state has its own constitution which binds the state government, these constitutions say that the property can only be taken for a public use. So even if the government does go through the procedures of eminent domain and does pay you compensation, it's still illegal and unconstitutional if they don't do it for the right kind of purpose, for a public use. And obviously, there has been debate about exactly what counts as a public use, and the most high-profile decision that the Supreme Court has made on that in recent decades is the Kelo decision, which we're about to talk about, I think.
Well, actually, before that, let's go back to before Kelo. There were a few very important cases about this topic, weren't there? Wasn't there a case out of Hawaii and maybe another one out of Michigan?
Yes, there were a lot of cases dating back some 200 years. From the very beginning, almost, there has been a debate between what I call the broad view of public use and the narrow view. The narrow view says that there is only a public use if the property is taken for some sort of government-owned project, such as a road, for example, or if it's given to a private owner, it has to be one that has a legal duty to serve the entire public, like a public utility, for example. On the other hand, the broad view says that anytime there might be some potential public benefit from the condemnation or from the new use, then it counts as a public use. Perhaps even the government doesn't really need to prove that the supposed public benefit will actually happen. They just have to assert it or make some minimally plausible claim that it will occur.
Right. And so an example of a narrow use that most people would probably agree was subject to eminent domain is if the government has to build a road.
And it's, yes, that's right.
Okay, so that's classic. Everybody agrees the government can take your property if it feels like it has to build a road in a certain area or widen a road or something. But the broader view would be things that are not so directly for public use, things like taking your property and then using it for some nebulous public purpose that supposedly is going to enhance the economy or somehow improve the public good.
Yeah, it's transferring it to a new private owner who has no special legal duty to serve the entire public, but the hope is that the new owner can create some sort of benefit for the community that might not otherwise happen.
Okay, and so this debate's been going on for a long time. And what was the status of the law before the Kelo decision of 2005?
So in the 18th and in the 19th century, the narrow view of public use predominated. Not everybody agreed with it, but it was certainly the dominant view held by most state courts and by the rare federal court decision that addressed this issue during that time, because most takings are done by state or local governments. And during most of the 19th century and even into the early 20th century, it was thought that the Bill of Rights, including the Fifth Amendment, which includes the public use restriction, it was thought that those didn't apply to the states, but only applied to federal governments. At that time, you had mostly state decisions. Mm-hmm. But in the early 20th century, the broad view began to make progress for reasons that we can talk about. And in 1954, in the case of Berman versus Parker, the Supreme Court pretty much endorsed the broad view. They said that a public use can be virtually anything the government says it is. This ended up licensing numerous urban development takings where huge numbers of people were forcibly displaced from their homes, mostly poor and minorities, and the land would be transferred to well-organized, usually wealthier kinds of interests. Many hundreds of thousands of people were displaced.
That was one of the reasons, wasn't it, in the 20th century, perhaps with the best of motives, perhaps not, there was all this focus on slum clearance or urban renewal, as it came to be called. And as you've just pointed out, entire communities would be taken. Now, it just happens that my producer and I, Wayne Winkler, are both from Detroit. And there was a vibrant middle class black community in downtown Detroit. I believe the area was called Black Bottom, wasn't it, Wayne? Yeah, Black Bottom. And the government simply decided that that's where they wanted to put the new highway and came in and took it. Now, that's a little bit less of a broad view of eminent domain. I mean, it was a road that was being constructed. But beyond that, vast swaths of the city were simply cleared so that they could be redeveloped in a better way that typically didn't include the residents.
Yes, one of the driving forces behind the support for the broad view in the early to mid 20th century was this idea that you needed to be able to condemn whole neighborhoods to fix them up, supposedly to cure social diseases. The analogy was often made between doing this sort of thing and doctors curing medical diseases, that sometimes you need to cut out some diseased tissue in order to cure the patient. So similarly, it was thought that to cure social diseases, as they were sometimes called, what you needed to do was clear out entire supposedly diseased neighborhoods, move the people somewhere else, and start over with government planning and with the help of private developers in those particular areas. And I think the Berman decision by the Supreme Court in 1954 reflected that mentality, though sadly, when these sorts of programs were actually implemented, they often caused enormous harm. They took poor people and often ended up putting them in even worse conditions than before, and they often ended up destroying more economic development than they actually created.
Yeah, it's a very sad thing. And there was another example from Michigan that I recall from my own youth. General Motors, I believe, wanted to build a great big facility, and Wayne's nodding along with me here. He remembers the Pole Town controversy. There was a vibrant Polish community in Detroit near the independent city of Hamtramck, which is also what was at that time majority Polish immigrants. And GM wanted to build this great big plant and so simply came in and used the state of Michigan to condemn it. And once the government had condemned it, it turned it over to a private entity, General Motors, which then built this great big factory, which never really took off. But in the meantime, a whole bunch of Polish families were displaced and a whole community was destroyed.
Yes, the Pole Town case, which happened in 1981, was one of the first signs that maybe the supposed consensus in favor of the broad view of public use was beginning to be challenged. This taking forcibly displaced over 4,000 people, so as to give the property to General Motors to build a new factory, just like you said. The Michigan Supreme Court did in fact approve this in a 5-2 decision, but there were very strong dissents. Moreover, there was a lot of public protest on both the right and the left, and a lot of people thought that it shouldn't be permitted to condemn what was perfectly good private property and then transfer it to a powerful private interest simply on the basis that that interest might produce more economic development for the community. And in fact, as you said, they never did actually produce anywhere near as much development as was promised. It was promised that there would be over 6,000 new jobs. In fact, there were never more than barely half that many. And the state and city governments spent an enormous amount of money for relatively modest return. Of course, they also destroyed all of these homes, businesses, schools, and other institutions. So a lot of people at the time said, both some lawyers and judges, but also just a lot of ordinary people said that maybe it should not be permissible to use eminent domain for this kind of purpose. And this was one of the first events where in the late 20th century, there was some significant sentiment that maybe we should rethink what we've done with the doctrine of public use.
But Ilya, isn't what's good for General Motors good for the country?
Well, it turned out not to be so in this case.
I guess not. Well, that was a big issue when I was growing up, and a big issue when I was in college, actually. And I remember reading about it and feeling so very sorry for those people. But that's the landscape basically then before Kelo. You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. This week we're talking about property rights and the aftermath of the notorious Kelo decision of 2005. We've been speaking with Professor Ilya Soman of George Mason University. And after the break, we'll finish our discussion with him, and then we'll speak with another guy, Pat Baker, all about mineral rights. Stick around. You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to finish our discussion with Ilya Soman, a professor of law at George Mason University. He's telling us about the Kelo decision of 2005 and the aftermath of that decision, what it means for property rights in the United States.
By the 1990s, a number of state Supreme Courts had begun to reverse the broad definition of public use and endorse a narrower one under their state constitution. Obviously, they couldn't make changes in the interpretation of the federal constitution. So this seeming consensus in favor of the broad view was beginning to crack. In 2004, the Michigan Supreme Court even reversed the Polltown decision and said that it was no longer permissible in Michigan to condemn property and give it to a private party simply for the basis of promoting economic development, as was true in the Polltown case. And this led some people to think that maybe you could get the federal Supreme Court to rethink the broad definition of public use under the federal constitution as well. If these state courts could do it, maybe the federal court could also change its mind and alter its previous precedents. And the Institute for Justice, a leading public interest law firm that sought to increase judicial protection for property rights, they were looking around for a case that would be a good vehicle to do this. And the case they found was the Kelo case that arose in New London, Connecticut. And this was a city that had fallen in somewhat difficult times. So they said, we need some more economic development. And the project they hit upon was that Pfizer Inc., one of the world's largest pharmaceutical manufacturers, would build a new headquarters in the area. And in conjunction with that deal, the city, with the aid of a private group called the New London Development Corporation, they would condemn some property near the new headquarters and turn it into various kinds of facilities, hotels, office space, upper-income housing that would be would work productively in conjunction with the Pfizer facility. But in order to build this thing, they decided that they needed to seize some 100 properties that were in the area. Some of the owners sold, quote unquote, voluntarily, though really, in many cases, they were pressured to sell by various underhanded tactics that we can talk about.
What were some of those tactics?
First of all, obviously, they threatened them with eminent domain if they refused to sell. Second, they did things like harass the people, make threatening phone calls in the middle of the night. Mm. In some cases, they would even turn off your utilities and the like. There was a whole slew of tactics, some perhaps legal, others probably very much not so. And when I interviewed some of the people who went through this, they felt very intimidated. So I think some people did sell through genuinely voluntary agreement, but a good many of the people who in theory sold voluntarily, in practice, that's not what happened at all. They were subject to a great deal of harassment and they said, I don't want to deal with it. Or at the very least, they were told that their property would be condemned if they didn't sell voluntarily, and that threat was what made the decisive difference. Yeah. But the owners of 15 residential properties said that they wouldn't sell. And eventually they got together with the Institute for Justice, which represented them for free in both the state and eventually the federal courts. And they argued that this is not for a public use. These neighborhoods, unlike the ones in Berman versus Parker, this neighborhood was not blighted or dilapidated. It was perfectly good lower middle class housing. There's pictures of the houses in my books. You can see for yourself, you know, that it was, you know, there wasn't anything in particularly wrong with it. And so they said, this is not a public use. This is just a purely private use and therefore unconstitutional. The case went eventually to the Connecticut Supreme Court, which narrowly upheld it under both the federal and state constitutions in a 4-3 decision. Then the lawyers for the property owners asked the federal Supreme Court to take the case. And to the surprise of most experts, including myself, the federal Supreme Court actually did take it. We were surprised because everybody thought this issue was settled. We'd had the Berman decision from back in 1954 and another Supreme Court decision since then, which said that the court endorses the broad view of public use. So it was thought, well, all knowledgeable people agree that the broad view of public use is correct. We settled this issue. But the court did take this case and it was very dramatic, but the Supreme Court eventually did uphold the takings, but in an extremely close 5-4 decision with very powerful dissents by Justice Sandra Day O'Connor and also by Justice Clarence Thomas. So even though the court said it is perfectly permissible to take property, give it to a new private owner to promote economic development, and they even said that you don't even have to prove that the supposed development is actually going to occur. But in part because there were these powerful dissents, the supposed consensus on this issue was finally broken. And before Kelo, people like me who favor a narrower view of public use, you could dismiss us as either we're sort of weird extremists or we're people who really know nothing about constitutional law and don't understand this issue. After Kelo, we're part of the mainstream again. And, you know, a new debate began over this, particularly since, as we're about to discuss, it wasn't only some judges or legal scholars who were critical of Kelo. The decision met with an enormous public backlash, even with ordinary people.
Before we get to that, though, it's almost as if the Supreme Court was teasing you. You know, there was fairly well settled law. You were surprised when they took the case. I'm sure that people in your community were thinking, oh, this is our chance, the court signaling that it's willing to take a narrower view. And then not quite. That must have been a great disappointment to you.
Yeah, it was disappointing. We fell one vote short. But on the other hand, in some ways, we still gained relative to what existed before. First, when you have a close, highly controversial 5-4 decision, that means the spell has been broken and it's a live issue. Close 5-4 decisions, particularly ones that are highly controversial, are exactly the sort of thing that is a good chance that it might be overruled or narrowed in the future. And second, as I mentioned a moment ago, there was a massive backlash against Kelo in the general public. Most Supreme Court decisions are only noticed by experts and quickly forgotten by all but a few people. This was an incredible exception. There was right away massive public anger against the decision. Polls show that over 80% of the public disagreed with it. People as varied as the NAACP, Rush Limbaugh, and even Bernie Sanders were highly critical of the decision. Even for a socialist like Bernie Sanders, this was too aggressive an attack on private property for him to stomach. And more generally, many people on the left said this is taking the property of ordinary middle or lower class people for the benefit of powerful corporate interest, and so they didn't like it. And obviously, many people on the right also didn't like it. In the wake of Kelo, some 45 states enacted laws to limit eminent domain within their state. That's a record. No other Supreme Court decision in all of American history has generated this much legislation in response to it. And also, several state Supreme Courts said, you know what, we're not going to follow Kelo in interpreting our state constitution. Kelo might be the right interpretation of federal constitution, but under our state constitution, you're not allowed to take property from one private individual and give it to another simply on the basis that it might produce economic development. So,
okay, let me interrupt you there, Ilya, because that's a confusing concept to many people.
Sure.
In this particular circumstance, what the property owners were looking for was some sort of protection, some sort of limit from the Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution that would prevent the state of Connecticut or the city of New London or its authority from taking property and giving it to another private owner. They were looking for some sort of help in that regard. And essentially what the Supreme Court said was there's no help to be given if you know, the Constitution's not going to save you on this issue, property owners. But state constitutions and even state statutes can essentially say this: thank you very much, Supreme Court. You've told us that we, under the federal constitution, may take property under these circumstances, but we are now going to voluntarily limit ourselves at the state level and say, no, thank you. We don't want to do that here. And indeed, we're going to hold that our own constitution or our own statutes prevent us from doing that.
Yes, that's right. In addition to the federal constitution, we also have in this country 50 state constitutions. Each state has its own constitution, and the state government has to follow not only the federal constitution, but also the state constitution. And obviously, local governments have to follow their state's constitution as well. So there's a lot of times where the federal Supreme Court might say that the federal constitution doesn't limit a particular kind of government policy, but they might still be limited by state constitution. So,
and that's basically what the reaction's been then, is thanks but no thanks. We're not going to do that in our state.
Certainly, right? In many states, certainly by no means all. But as I mentioned earlier, several state Supreme Courts have said since Kelo that under their state constitutions, these kinds of takings are forbidden. Other states have enacted either new constitutional amendments to forbid these sorts of takings, or just ordinary laws which say that these kinds of takings are forbidden. All told, some 45 states have passed these kinds of laws, or constitutional amendments since Kelo, though more than half of them probably only pretend to ban these kinds of takings, but actually allow them to continue under other names.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to ask you about, Ilya, is what has been the actual on-the-ground effect of all of this reaction to Kelo? Has it actually resulted in fewer such condemnations?
I think so. It's difficult to precisely measure these things because sadly we don't have a national database of all condemnations and the purposes for which they're done. However, in some 20 states, there were in fact serious reforms passed that really did impose important new constraints on these sorts of takings. And as I mentioned earlier, several state Supreme Courts issued decisions saying these kinds of takings are either forbidden under their state constitutions or at least severely limited. So while there are also many states which pretended to reform their laws but actually didn't do very much, still in some 20 or more states, there has been important progress, and that has cracked down on these kinds of takings. In addition, I think there's been an intellectual shift that even though for the moment the Supreme Court says in this narrow 5-4 decision that these sorts of takings are perfectly fine, still the fact that there were these strong dissents and that there's now this active debate on the subject, that means the Kelo could well be overruled or limited in the future. Whereas before Kelo, most people thought that this issue was settled. It's never going to be reopened. All right-thinking people agree on this. After Kelo, you can't say that anymore. And I think there's a decent chance that the Supreme Court will sooner or later revisit Kelo.
You mentioned that some states only pretended to reform their laws and that they're doing these under other guises. Could you give us an example of that, of a state or a locality?
Sure. There's some 20 or more states which are like this, including even the state of Connecticut, which where this case began. And there's a number of different shenanigans that are used to achieve this result. But the most common one is to say you can't take property from one private individual and give it to another for, quote, economic development, like in the Kelo case, but you can do it for blight. And blight is defined so broadly that almost any property can be declared blighted. Under broad definitions of blight like this, such places as Times Square or downtown Las Vegas have been declared to be blighted. These are actual cases. So in some instances in states which have taken this approach, essentially you can do the exact same thing you could before, just under a different name.
But that's not even really much of a different name, Ilya. I mean, calling a place blighted simply means it's economically depressed and therefore suffering social ills. So when you take something because it's blighted, because you want to improve it, that's economic development. I mean, that's barely even changing the nomenclature.
It depends on the definition of blight under state law. Mm-hmm. In some states where the definition of blight is limited, you have to prove either that the property is severely dilapidated or that it poses some sort of threat to public health, like there are diseased rats on the site or things of this sort. In other states, on the other hand, where the definition of blight is very broad, it is indeed the case that all you have to prove, or all the government has to prove, is that there could potentially be more economic development in the area than there currently is. So that's very different from the layperson's definition of blight, but it is the legal definition of blight in all too many states. On the other hand, if you define blight narrowly, then something like the Kilo taking could not happen. If you look at the homes that were taken in Kilo, very few people could reasonably claim that they're blighted. They look like perfectly normal middle-class housing. Admittedly, the head of the NLDC, the private agency which did this condemnations on behalf of New London, she at times said, well, this is a slum and it's horrible. I frankly find it difficult to understand what it was that she was talking about there. I think the vast majority of people, when they see pictures of these homes, they may or may not like them, but they certainly look perfectly normal and not blighted at all.
Okay, crystal ball time. How long till Kilo gets overturned?
I don't know for sure that it even ever will be overturned. All I think is that there's a much higher chance than it for most cases that it will be. But if I had to predict, and obviously predictions are always iffy about such things, I would say there's a good chance that in the next 10 to 20 years, Kilo will either be overruled or at least the Supreme Court will revisit it and put tighter limits on these kinds of takings than exist in the Kilo case itself. For example, they might require that the government actually has to provide real proof that the supposed economic development will occur. Unlike in the Kilo case where the proof was extremely sketchy, and indeed, as it turned out, to this day, nothing has actually been built on the condemned site.
That's 12 years. Wow.
Yeah, this was a very badly conceived project, and it fell through. However, you can't say that nobody gained from this taking, because a colony of feral cats has taken up residence on the site.
Oh, my.
And they are the only regular users of it. There are also some feral cat shelters that some nice people have set up on the site, probably illegally. So you can say that certain structures were built. In addition, there is a proposal to, on part of the site, build a memorial to victims of eminent domain. So if that happens, there might be development of a kind.
I guess so. Well, Ilya, this has been fascinating. We really thank you for sharing this with us. Once again, what's the name of your book about Kilo?
It's called The Grasping Hand. Kilo versus the City of New London and the Limits of Eminent Domain. It's available at fine Amazon websites near you.
Thanks so much, Ilya.
Thank you.
You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and we've been speaking with Professor Ilya Soman of George Mason University all about the notorious Kilo decision of 2005 and how it's affected how the government can take your property. After the break, we'll switch gears and speak to Professor Pat Baker of the University of Tennessee at Martin, and he has something to tell us about mining and mineral rights. Stick around. It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. We've been speaking generally about property rights in the United States after the Kilo decision of 2005. Now let's get specific. In fact, let's talk about a specific issue that came to my attention recently when I was visiting the University of Tennessee at Martin and my good friend Pat Baker, who teaches there. Among other things, Pat is an expert in oil and gas law, and he tells me that there's an emerging issue that's affected by Kilo. Here's the issue. What happens after a coal company or an oil and gas company has taken the minerals out of your property? Traditionally, it seems that those mine voids, as they're called, were considered valueless and were not controversial. But now, maybe they're valuable. Maybe oil and gas companies can use those voids, those underground holes that are left, to store things like wastewater or natural gas. Oh, now there's value, and now people are arguing over who owns them.
So for a century, this was simply an afterthought. No one deemed it valuable, this space. And till recently, in the early 80s, 70s, people started to inject coal waste after mining into these voids. And so that was kind of the first beneficial use. And then there was also the reinjection
of natural gas. So there were waste
sites. Yeah, there were waste sites. And then actually some gas fields where the gas had been produced, the gas owner would inject the gas back in the ground and store it until there was a market for the gas. So there's been some use of these voids probably for 50 or 60 years, but very limited. But with technological advances, this space is becoming more and more important and valuable, because as we shift from coal to natural gas, as far as our makeup of our utilities, we have to build out the infrastructure for natural gas. And so what do you do with large amounts of natural gas until you need it? You have to store it. And so these old mine sites and these old pore spaces are great places to store natural gas until there's a demand or a market for it.
Very interesting. I've also heard of a more experimental use for it that coincides with solar or wind power, and that is you can have a generation station up above, and then you can actually store power as potential energy. That is, you can pump it either up or down when you've got excess power, and then you can release the water when there's more demand for the power and run the water over a turbine. It's kind of like filling up, refilling constantly or periodically the water behind a dam that has generation turbines in it, only you're doing it underground. And there are ways that people are talking about doing that using these mine voids here. So these really are valuable spaces.
Yeah, and then the other thing that the technology has been perfected, it's just not cost efficient, is re-injecting carbon and doing
carbon storage.
Yeah, what's called carbon sequestration, capturing the carbon that's produced by utilities and then injecting it back underground and storing it. So we're on the cutting edge here as far as technological development. And so these voids are going to become more valuable as time goes on. And so now that there's a value attached to it, the question is who owns it, right? And who owns nothing?
Who owns the nothing? That's very interesting. But you know, in a sense, though, it's really kind of like owning any building or any tank with a large internal space. In some sense, it's you don't own the space as much as you own the containment vessel.
Right.
And so my initial thought is that the landowner owns it, because the landowner owns the land that creates or that surrounds the void.
And so that's where it's really interesting. If you survey the states, each state, you know, the state has police powers. And so states have the ability to carve out their own property rules. And so what you see in different states is some states say that the coal owner owns it, some states say the surface owner. And so it's all over the board as far as the ownership of these spaces. There's a lot of inconsistency and there's a lot of questions out there as the law develops around this new property interest.
Yep. Well, you've mentioned a term there that reminds me that, of course, we have to find a constitutional nexus here somewhere, and it's really not that far. Police power, of course, refers to the general sovereign power of a state. And you're right. You know, property rules, property laws are going to vary from state to state, though there's a lot of commonality, of course. But the big constitutional issue here is the takings clause of the Fifth Amendment, right? That does impose a certain uniformity on all of us.
That's exactly right. And the Fifth Amendment limits the government from unconstitutionally taking property without paying just compensation. You know, the government's compelled to go through the eminent domain proceedings and to pay the property owner. And so here you have some states that have enacted legislation that essentially gives the void or the pore space to the mineral owner, which really defies long-standing property. The fact that you severed the coal doesn't mean that when the coal is exhausted and been produced that all of a sudden that you've severed the void. That was your intent, actually, in severing the coal was the complete opposite.
Using some lawyer talk here,
right.
So let's start at the beginning. I own some property. Let's say, as lawyers say, I own it completely in fee simple. It's my property all the way to the center of the earth. You come along one day, you're the coal company, and you say, I would like to mine your coal. And so you purchase something commonly called mineral rights.
Right.
And that gives you the legal authority to enter the land, to mine the coal in whatever fashion we agree upon, I suppose, or whatever fashion you choose once I've granted you the right. You come in, you might do some surface mining, or you might go deep shaft mining and create these voids, or you might sink some wells and pull out some oil or some gas. And all of this is pursuant to having the mineral rights. But at a certain point, you've exhausted them. Okay, you've taken out whatever oil or gas you're going to take out. And then what happens typically or traditionally at that point to the property?
Well, I mean, you still own the minerals if there are any other minerals on the property.
Who does?
the mineral owner.
So you, the coal company, would still own the coal if it was there, or the oil and gas
right.
if it was there. Okay.
But once that's been produced, you no longer have a ownership interest in the property, and so it's a determinable fee.
There just comes a point then where the parties agree, okay, the mineral rights have now been exhausted?
Exactly.
Okay, so that there actually is like a formal piece of paper someone signs from the coal company.
Well, and I don't know necessarily that there could be, right? If you had a lease document.
Right.
But if you go back to these severance documents from the late 1800s, mm-hmm. most states in their case law have found that when the coal is exhausted or the mineral company or owner abandons the property, i.e. that they stop mining, that at that point their interest ends. Just like any easement, when you have an easement, once you abandon that easement, the easement terminates, and that interest then reverts back to the owner of the property, which in this case would be the surface owner.
Okay, so the coal company comes in, you come in, you take the coal out of my property. One day I notice you simply closed up shop and left. And so at that point, your mineral rights are now exhausted, your easement, as you say. Your determinable fee, as lawyers like to say, has now been determined, and you're done. So the property's now mine, voids and all. That has been the traditional treatment of these properties. Okay, so it comes back to me. So just to finish the thought, it seems to be that I should own the voids. And if subsequently some value exists in those voids or in that poor land, is that what you call it, poor land?
Well, I don't call it poor land. I call it poor space.
Poor
but you're
space.
Right, in that vacuum, basically.
Right, in that vacuum, if there's any value in that, that should be mine, shouldn't it?
That's the premise of the paper, is that should revert back to the surface owner, that they should then have the ownership interest in that void to lease it or sell it or do whatever they want with it. And no one has contested this, but once again, in the last 20 or 30 years with technology, now all of a sudden it's becoming a more and more valuable commodity, and so there's a dispute as far as who owns it, right? I mean, you and I are not going to argue over who owns a piece of gravel, for instance, right? We could care less about it.
Right.
But we are going to argue over who owns a diamond, for instance. And so once there's value, right, the stakes are raised.
So just in our hypothetical, you stop and then 40 years later, you show back up and you tell me, oh, well, I want to store some natural gas down in this void, or I want to do something else down here. I want to inject some wastewater down in this void, or whatever I want to do with it. And your position is that you still have the right to do that because of your mineral rights. And my position is, what are you doing back on my property? You guys already took all the minerals out.
That's exactly right.
Okay. And you say this has not been litigated.
Well, it has not been litigated. But some states have passed statutes which have simply created the presumption or the right in the mineral owner that they still own this void, that they have an ownership. And so unless the lease or the severance document specifically reserves the void or pore space to the surface owner, the mineral owner then is able to show back up basically and say, look, I own it now. The state legislature has found that through statutory enactment that I own it. And so now as the coal owner, what am I going to do? I'm going to lease that to this natural gas company to store natural gas, or I'm going to, inject, like you say, wastewater or possibly old frack fluid from natural gas or even carbon sequestration. So there's a lot of uses here, and so now there's a value to it.
At the risk of sounding cynical, I suspect that the state legislature did not pass these statutes of their own volition. They did so perhaps at the behest or the urging of the lobbyists that were paid for by these mining interests.
Absolutely.
In fact, the property owners probably weren't even thinking about this.
No.
I mean, they might not even been aware this was going on, and then all of a sudden they see some mineral company out there injecting natural gas on their property. They say, what's going on? Oh, well, we still own this. The legislature says so.
Right. Exactly.
They enacted the statute that we wrote for them.
Right.
And sorry.
And what's also interesting is that when you look at these court decisions as far as people severing their minerals or in a contractual dispute, the question is always, well, what did the parties intend?
Mm-hmm.
And so if you think back to 1875, for instance, when my great-great-grandfather severed the coal on my 200-acre farm in Clay County, Kentucky, the reality of it is, he didn't intend to sever the void, and the coal company wasn't thinking about purchasing the void. And so really, at the end of the day, neither party intended, they didn't intend anything in the document as far as this void or pore space is
concerned. So again, under the common law and under the common understanding, That would have gone back to your granddad.
Exactly.
And did go back to your granddad, but now the coal companies are showing up on your granddad's property, or theoretically they could, and say, oh, no, no, we still own the void, and right. So now we're going to start using it.
Yeah, or the oil and gas company. And I'm just using that as an example. My grandfather's not from Clay County. I'm just saying, like, hypothetically. That could happen.
Okay.
And so simultaneously you have this other issue, which is the Fifth Amendment and takings.
Right, in enacting these statutes,
yeah.
Has the Commonwealth of Virginia or some other state that does something similar, has it taken property in the constitutional meaning? And I think there's a pretty strong argument that it has, because obviously this is a valuable thing and it's involving physical entry onto the property.
Exactly.
I mean, they're building facilities.
Right, pipelines, that's exactly right.
All this sort of stuff, oh my goodness.
And what's really, I think, raises the stakes is Kelo versus the City of New London.
Could you reacquaint us with that case?
Well, so in Kelo, a private developer approached the city and said, if you declare eminent domain and transfer this property to me, we'll take an area that is underused and dilapidated, and we're going to create housing developments and businesses. It's going to bring 1,000 jobs and tax revenue. And so the fourth requirement of any eminent domain proceeding is that there's a public use, and that goes to the Supreme Court. And the U.S. Supreme Court finds, I think in a 5-4 decision, if I'm correct, that they never meant, or that the court has never limited private use to be as narrow as what the plaintiffs were arguing in the case.
And I think the distinction was between public use, which is what the actual Fifth Amendment says, and the idea of public purpose, which might be a bit broader. So, for example, the government can take my property if it wants to build a public road on it.
Exactly.
That's a public use. That's well established. And all the Fifth Amendment says is that when they do it for that purpose, they have to compensate me fairly. So most eminent domain cases are basically just arguing over money.
That's exactly right.
But if it's not for a clear public use, but for something that's more attenuated, such as taking my property and giving it to another private individual or company, so that that company can then develop it in a way that arguably is going to enhance the local economy, that's not a public use. It's a private use.
That's exactly right.
But maybe it's for a public purpose, at least from the perspective of the local government. And that was the situation in Kelo, and unfortunately for Mrs. Kelo, she lost. The United States Supreme Court said that the Fifth Amendment embraced that idea, and that there was nothing in the Constitution to prohibit the City of New London, or actually it was a local development authority, from condemning that property on that basis. So in other words, it is constitutional for a government to take your property and give it to me, as long as they're doing it because they think I'm going to do something to help the local community. And that struck a lot of people the wrong way. And so it led to all sorts of responses.
Right, and that's this anti-Kelo movement. And so you see a variety of different statutes and constitutional amendments across the country limiting the state's ability to declare eminent domain. And as you and I both know, the U.S. Constitution is a floor, not a ceiling. And so states are free then to pass more restrictive or more protective constitutional rights. And so a lot of states
Let's just talk about that again. That's something people get unclear about. The U.S. The Constitution is the supreme law of the land. And if there is any conflict between the U.S. Constitution and any state law, including a state constitution, the U.S. Constitution is going to prevail.
Yeah.
But what this Constitution does is it provides only very minimal protection against this sort of condemnation. So basically what the Supreme Court was saying is, if you're going to do this sort of condemnation, this eminent domain action, nothing in the U.S. Constitution stops you. On the other hand, if as a state government, you want to limit your own ability to do that, then nothing in the Constitution prohibits that either.
That's exactly right.
You're providing more protection for property owners than the U.S. Constitution provides, but that's okay. You can do that. It's not a conflict with the U.S. Constitution. You're basically just giving more protection in your state laws. So a number of states did that, either through statutes or even constitutional amendments, saying, well, the U.S. Supreme Court might let us take your property, but we're not going to do it.
And that's what Virginia does. Virginia passes a constitutional amendment to the state constitution that provides a much more limited and restricted power by the state to
declare. A much narrower definition of public use.
So you can't take it, for instance, for economic growth. You can't take it for a private party, for instance. It can't be for jobs. I mean, it's quite exhaustive as far as the limits, and it still carves out those exceptions for utilities, for instance, to be able to declare eminent domains like
power lines
and railroads. But it's very restrictive as far as the state's ability or the local government's ability to declare eminent domain and then essentially transfer the property to a private party.
So now I think I'm following you. The argument would be that since the state, the Commonwealth of Virginia, has restricted its own ability to condemn property, essentially said, we're not going to condemn property in Virginia and take one private property owner's land and give it to another private property owner. We're just not going to do that. Does this statute creating a presumption of ownership in the coal companies rather than in the landowner, does it constitute a taking that's unconstitutional pursuant to the state constitution of Virginia?
And that's the argument in the paper, is that you could argue, especially since a lot of these statutes dealing with the pore space and the mine voids were passed before the anti-Kelo legislation. And so essentially giving the property to the mineral owner, or a strong presumption in the mineral owner, and then the state then enacts a constitutional amendment, all right, which would preempt a statute, basically declaring the statute unconstitutional. It hasn't been challenged yet, but as this space becomes more valuable and there's more demand, I think that argument exists. And there's some other limits on state police power, such as the public trust doctrine and the Commerce Clause. But this taking argument is a very tangible, real argument, I think, that can be made, because essentially what the state is doing is an end run around the Fifth Amendment.
Very interesting. So if I'm the property owner and you're the coal company and you show up and start installing pipelines and stuff on my property, and you say, I can do this because Virginia says I can, my first line of defense might be, no, Virginia can't do that because that violates Virginia's own constitution.
That's exactly right.
And my argument would be, pursuant to the law before the statute, this property was mine. The statute changed it, and then it took my property away from me and took it from one private property owner and gave it to another private property
because
owner.
The whole point of this is economic growth and economic benefit, which is specifically addressed in Virginia's anti-Kelo legislation.
Yeah, in fact, it's even a less compelling factual circumstance than Kelo itself, because remember, in Kelo itself, it was a supposedly really depressed area.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was Squibb, wasn't it? I think it was Squibb Pharma. It was a pharmaceutical company.
Yes.
Well, maybe it was Pfizer, one of the big ones. Was promising that they were going to revitalize this town. Well, you know, you can see the argument there.
Right.
It's a form of urban revitalization. But nobody could argue that putting pipelines onto your property is going to revitalize your local community. I mean, how many jobs would be created? It'd be a few construction jobs, and then somebody would be there to monitor it every month or something. So it's not going to revitalize your county, them doing this. So it's even a more attenuated argument from their perspective. Very interesting. Where'd you publish your article?
Professor Webb and myself published it in Oil, Gas, and Energy Quarterly, which is associated with LSU. Louisiana State University. And so it's published there, and people can find it at LexisNexis. And it just came out in September, so it'll be interesting to see if it gains some traction. But it's a very interesting argument, and it's something that is going to become more important as we look for ways to deal with climate change, the storage of oil and gas, dealing with pollutants, and like you said, using it for renewable energy. So it's a hot topic. It's not going away in our lifetimes.
And I bet there's some lawyers out there in the Commonwealth of Virginia who are very eagerly reading your article even now.
Yeah, and I'll be happy to give them a copy.
Pat Baker of the University of Tennessee at Martin, thanks very much for your time.
Stuart, thanks. Always a pleasure. Really appreciate being on the show, and go Skyhawks.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Ilya Soman, a professor of law at George Mason University, for giving us that update on the Kelo decision. Thanks also to my good friend Pat Baker of the University of Tennessee at Martin for telling us about the specific issue of who owns nothing, who owns what's left over after property is mined. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our production intern is Donald Crenshaw. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. Check them out on SoundCloud. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.